Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte, the first Useful Idiots show of 2025. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
If you were in a position to celebrate the holidays, hope you had a good one. If you hated the holidays, then let's celebrate the fact that they're over.
Yeah.
And we're back to normal, to real life. And there's so much craziness to catch up on. We took a few days off of Useful Idiots, so a lot of things to get to. And on today's show, we're going to hear a really harrowing account from a frontline doctor who's been on the ground in Gaza several times about the latest there. And it's a very bleak picture, but it's very essential. Like, the least we can do in this time of genocide is bear witness. And that's what we do today.
And as always, we encourage you to go to usefulidiotspodcast.com, where you can see extended interviews as well as Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. And this week's is really a doozy. This week, though, we will have the entire interview will be public. But in general, when you are members at usefulidiotspodcast.com, you get the full interview.
All right, let's get to our four basic food groups, starting with Democrats suck. MSNBC is doing some, year-end reflecting. It's a new era with Donald Trump about to come back to office and Democrats still grappling with the loss of the White House and the, you know, pending exit of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And all of a sudden, MSNBC is sounding like the show, I don't know, Useful Idiots. Let's hear directly from Simone Sanders, a former Biden White House staffer.
Well, and that is why I made the point yesterday about organize. I mean, people often talk about, I mean, this has literally been going on since Fred Hampton, but I mean, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Dr. King, right? Heck, Bernie Sanders talked about organizing across class as well, because the reality is when you align just along, if we're going to just specifically talk about white people for a second, okay? If we just talk about aligning just across race, we are seeing the divisions happening right now. The billionaire, the white billionaires, Elon Musk is not saying, yes, I'm fighting for the little guy. Yes, I'm out here, you know, looking out for the forgotten white man. He is saying these folks are mediocre and let me get somebody else to do it, which is why folks, white, black, Latino, Native American, Asian American, and Pacific Islander and otherwise, we have to look at organizing across class, okay? Because the reality is what they said, as Michael said, what they said about black people all those years ago, and they're still trying to say it about us, to be very clear. Mm-hmm. Now they're saying it out loud about people who are not black, about you, okay? First they came for us, now they're coming for you. You are not exempt, boo-boo.
Now, what's notable, by the way, is that before working for Joe Biden and then for Kamala Harris, Simone Sanders worked for Bernie Sanders. Of course, she abandoned Bernie Sanders. And she lied during the primary about CDC reports. She basically, when Bernie Sanders wanted to pause the primaries because of COVID, she lied and said the CDC had said it was safe to gather to vote, even though it had actually recommended not doing that. Just an example of one of her greatest hits.
What she's saying now in 2024 is exactly what people like her and the rest of the, you know, Democratic establishment have been poo-pooing for so long, which is that we should organize along class lines, that it's not just about ethnic identity, it's also about class. But now that after Democrats have lost yet another election to Trump, where Trump and his campaign weaponized class issues and falsely portrayed themselves as working class champions and pointed out the accurate fact that Democrats had abandoned the working class, now all of a sudden on MSNBC they can say what, you know, shows like this have been saying for a very, very long time. And Simone Sanders can invoke, you know, not just like Fred Hampton, but also Bernie Sanders,
right,
who she repeatedly trashed and threw under the bus. And basically the attitude of the Democratic Party has been that of Hillary Clinton. You remember back in 2016. And you, Katie, you quote this all the time when, like, what did Hillary say about Bernie's proposal?
Will breaking up the banks end racism? No.
Exactly.
The worst. Yeah.
Exactly. Well,
and you know what? Really, of course, the reason that they're saying this now and people are finally saying Bernie was right about certain things is because they know Bernie won't run again. That's part of the reason that they're saying these things.
Yeah.
Now it's but also safe.
maybe finally they're recognizing that like this whole strategy of just being like the party of identitarian politics and like ignoring class is a complete failure. And maybe after two out of three times losing to Trump, some reality is sinking in. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll come around to supporting Medicare for all.
Yeah, that would be great.
I mean, some of them already have, and then they backtracked on that. Like Kamala Harris famously co-sponsored Bernie's Medicare for All resolution. And then when she ran this time, she said she no longer believes in that. So maybe, yeah.
And I also think that the Luigi Mangione thing and the kind of like bipartisan support of him shows that this really was an issue to run on. But of course, Kamala Harris didn't.
When you say bipartisan, you mean like from the ground below.
Oh, sorry. I don't mean like Republican politicians and Democratic politicians. I mean, in terms of the just ordinary people on the left and the right. But, you know, I have to say there's an argument that I hear all the time, and it is so dumb, which is you can't organize around class because people are racist. It's like, no, that's exactly why you do organize around class, because that's one of the ways to combat racism. Like if you don't give people an identity to organize around that isn't race, then it's much easier for them to be manipulated and pitted against each other. It's just such a it's such weird logic. It's the exact opposite of what it should be. Anyway, well, congrats Democrats for saying finally coming around on this. A little too late, but better late than never, I guess.
It's just too bad that nobody watches MSNBC anymore, so no one's around to hear them finally report the truth.
Right, you know,
but hey.
We know that they watch us, apparently, including Simone Sanders.
Yes. Well, maybe we'll give them a little bump here by acknowledging their moment of sanity.
Yeah. Maybe people will start watching MSNBC again now that we are vouching for them. So for Republican sucks. So as people probably know, on New Year's morning, Shamsuddin Bahar Jabbar, an American citizen raised in Texas as a Christian and a former active duty Army member from Texas, drove into a crowd of people partying on Bourbon Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And he killed at least 15 people and he injured over 30. Somehow, Donald Trump and others decided that this person was an immigrant and not from the United States. Let's take a look at what Trump said on Truth Social. So he wrote, "Our country is a disaster, a laughingstock all over the world. This is what happens when you have open borders with weak, ineffective, and virtually non-existent leadership. The DOJ, FBI, and Democrat state and local prosecutors have not done their job." About an hour after posting this falsehood, he doubled down and said Trump was right about everything, even though by then it was clear that this person was not a foreigner. Now, it wouldn't have been okay for him to be xenophobic and bring up open borders had they been, but it just rich that the person happened to be born in the United States and also that he doubled down. But Trump wasn't the only person who was pointing his finger at interesting enemies on this. Let's take a look at what Louisiana Senator John Kennedy had to say.
"I will promise you this. I will, when it is appropriate and this investigation is complete, you will find out what happened and who was responsible, or I will raise fresh hell. And I will chase those in the federal government who are responsible for telling us what happened, like they stole Christmas."
So I don't really understand what he means about treating them as if they stole Christmas. But I guess for him, that's a very bad thing to do. I guess, isn't that what the Grinch did? So is he comparing like the government to the Grinch and somehow blaming the Grinch for this attack?
Yeah, as far as I know, actually, stealing Christmas is the worst crime under U.S. law. It's like, it is official. If you steal Christmas, it's punishable by like not just one death row sentence, but like multiple death row sentences. Like you're executed also in the next lifetime as well, because that's how serious this crime is, to steal Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting hell rained down on you by John Kennedy.
Yeah, but obviously he feels very strongly about theft of Christmas as opposed to like, you know, just murder.
Right.
For him, theft of Christmas is a bigger offense than killing people.
Right.
But, you know, which is an interesting line. He's a very colorful character. But, you know, back to Trump, when he talked about, you know, this is a result of open borders, maybe he means like open borders between states, like because this suspect comes from Texas, right? Maybe he's crossing state lines. Maybe Trump is advocating that we just, you know, we seal everybody off now within their state. That could be a new approach to MAGA.
That is true. Yeah. States' rights, shut down the state's borders. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, maybe he is right.
I mean, that would be horrible, especially for women seeking abortions in Trump's America, because then they'd be prevented from not only getting abortion in their own state, but then even making the trek to a neighboring state.
Right.
For their right to abortion,
which in some cases they do criminalize or try to criminalize doing that.
There we go. We already have that. That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
All right. So what do we got for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, because we've been away, we're gonna have a double feature for Isn't That Weird, because there's so much weirdness in this weird country. Starting with a man named Patrick Bet David. He is a pretty prominent podcast host. His company is called Valuetainment, which I think is the funniest name for like any company I've ever heard. Valuetainment. Yeah, I mean, it's something kind of sweet about it. It's like, hey, I'm providing value and also entertainment, and it's so valuable. I think it's kind of endearing. But as a window into where he derives, you know, his value-oriented content, Patrick Bet David gave a tour of what he called his thinking room, featuring what I imagine is one of his most prized possessions. It's a painting, a commissioned painting of himself alongside other prominent figures. And let's take a look.
You got this painting that I worked on and commissioned Brent Hill. You see me in here in the blue. Then we have Senna, Ayrton Senna. Then it's Tupac, the Shah of Iran, Lincoln, Kennedy, Einstein. Bunch of different hidden messages in there.
So for our audio audience, he's, you know, in front of a painting that he's commissioned. And you see himself. He's like, he's in the back and looking nice in a very sharp blue suit. He's standing next to the racing.
Like Nancy Pelosi, champion. Aaron.
Like Nancy Pelosi. He's standing next to the racing champion, Senna. And then to his right is Tupac, you know, a man after my heart, because Tupac is also one of my inspirational figures. If I ever commission such a painting, I definitely have Tupac in there with me too. And then he's also flanked by Abraham Lincoln and the Shah of Iran, and we see also JFK, Einstein. Who's that man sitting down there on the right?
I don't know.
But also looks like Dr. King, right? I think maybe to at the very far right of the painting. Anyway, and then Patrick Bet David.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of Patrick, I think of Einstein.
And they're debating two books, Atlas Shrugged and Communist Manifesto. This is my thinking room. If I want to think, I come here, I close up, and I start thinking.
They're debating Atlas Shrugged, okay, like seminal.
Great Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand versus the Communist Manifesto.
Wow.
You know, on our Thursday Throwdown this week, we talked about the Communist Manifesto. And in fact, I acknowledged I hadn't read it. So maybe this is, you know, this is why I need to listen to more Valuetainment. So
yeah, exactly.
You know,
and we said we were going to do a reading group, so maybe he could join it. I mean, he's obviously, hopefully he's read it, but either way, I think because, you know, his intervention would be both valuable and entertaining, obviously.
The only, many prominent figures have these kinds of paintings commissioned, but the one I know of for sure is Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson also commissioned a painting of himself with some prominent figures, and just as a bonus, I'll show it to you guys. This is, I guess, something that like rich and famous people do, is like, it's not enough to be like rich and famous. They also have to like just, you know, exalt themselves even further by like getting commissioned paintings with them with like really important historical figures. So there it is. This is from the Michael Jackson estate. This is like commissioned by MJ.
Wow.
I see him there. I see Einstein, I see JFK, Lincoln, Charlie Chaplin, Elvis.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that Walt Disney to his left?
Maybe that is Disney. I think you're right.
Or is it Thurgood Marshall? And who's the guy to the right of Einstein?
Okay, so in the picture, at the far left, we have Lincoln, Kennedy, Edison. There we go, Edison.
Oh, got it.
Einstein. Walt Disney, you're right.
Walt Disney. Charlie Chaplin.
Elvis and Little Richard.
Okay, got it. Wow, interesting. I mean, he basically ripped off a lot. Patrick Ben Patrick Bet David. Yeah. Ripped off a lot of MJ's figures, but he did not have Michael Jackson did not have the Shah of Iran, and that's an interesting.
That's true. Nor did he have this fascinating debate over the Communist Manifesto versus Atlas Shrugged, which it captures the struggle of our time. So
yeah.
I'd say Patrick David, but David takes the cake here.
Yeah.
So that's the first half of our Isn't That Weird. Now, we also wanted to turn to Syria, you know, where there's just been regime change, and now Syria is trying to chart a new course. But a major problem that Syria faces is not only does the U.S. still have sanctions imposed on Syria, which, by the way, it's not lifting. Funnily enough, like right before Assad was overthrown, the U.S. passed a new round of sanctions, right? Which, as we've covered on the show, are designed to basically destroy Syria's economy and prevent reconstruction. And these sanctions were tucked into a must-pass bill because they were included as part of the Pentagon budget, which has to pass, right? Because for the U.S., what's more important than funding the military-industrial complex for another year? So the sanctions got included in this bill, which passed. And then by the time Assad was overthrown, it was too late to remove them. So Biden then signed these new sanctions into law after Assad was overthrown, which put the people who support these sanctions in a really awkward position, because their whole line before forever was that these sanctions don't hurt the Syrian people. Right. They're just targeting Assad. But now that Assad's gone, they've lost their excuse to pretend as if the sanctions don't hurt people. And now they're in the position where they've just imposed sanctions again on the Syrian people without their pretext anymore for doing so. So now some of them, including Congressmember French Hill, have said we have to lift these sanctions, like because we need to, you know, build goodwill with the Syrian people and help reconstruction. So he's admitting that sanctions before were the Syrian people. So there's the sanctions thing. Then there's also the fact that the U.S. is occupying Syria's oil and wheat fields. And similar to the sanctions, the point of this occupation was not to fight ISIS, as the U.S. said, but it was to just deprive Syria of its oil and wheat so the people suffered and the government would collapse, which now has been achieved. And now that it's kind of mission accomplished in the sense that Assad's been overthrown, the Pentagon has all of a sudden admitted something really interesting. They said, oops, we have a lot more troops.
I like it. It rhymes.
Before, the official line was that we had 900 troops. Well, Pentagon spokesperson Pat Ryder just came out and said, actually, this is the real number.
I want to bring up one item. As you know, we have been briefing you regularly that there are approximately 900 U.S. troops deployed to Syria. In light of the situation in Syria and the significant interest, we recently learned that those numbers were higher. And so asked to look into it, I learned today that, in fact, there are approximately 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria. As I understand it, as it was explained to me, these additional forces are considered temporary rotational forces that deploy to meet shifting mission requirements, whereas the core 900 deployers are on longer-term deployments. And as you know, for many of our deployments, numbers will fluctuate from time to time. But given that this number is significantly higher than what we've been briefing, I wanted to let you know as soon as I found out this information.
Thanks so much for the update. Good to know that we have actually more than 100% of the troops than we actually said we had. And the reason why this is being kept so secret is because, again, the official pretext is we're there to fight ISIS. But what these troops have actually been doing is, as Trump said, we're there to take the oil. And not surprised at all that the numbers are far higher than what we've been told, because this has been just a major deception going on for a very long time.
Also, this guy, I mean, he's pretty high up in the Pentagon, right?
And yeah, he just learned it.
As it was explained to me.
Yeah.
Does he work in like food services in the Pentagon or something?
He just learned. He said, I learned today.
Yeah.
Oops. Yeah.
He's really, I like it. I like a guy who doesn't micromanage.
Yeah.
He's very hands off. But, you know, I think that as someone who I myself struggle with executive functioning, and I think that's probably the issue for the Pentagon as well, because they can't keep track of their money either. You know, they're always like finding money at the last minute.
That's true. Like for Ukraine, too. They're like, oops, we found another $10 billion. Here it is.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's this installment of Oops, We Found More Troops. And who knows if we'll be getting an update from Pat Ryder soon, where he might be saying, oops, it's actually 20,000, not 2,000. I know, right. I told you 2,000, 20,000.
As it was explained to me. Yeah.
As it was explained to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for isn't that terrible? Let's take a look at some like random Israelis, what they have to say about the people of Gaza.
How many civilians have been killed in Gaza, from what you know?
Who gives a shit?
Okay, but don't you feel like, for example, children?
Children grow up to be Arabs.
By the way, I like that. You know, some people will say that children grow up to be terrorists. Like one of the, you know, Hasbara talking points to justify genocide is that all these kids are going to grow up to be terrorists. But for her, she's actually much more cautious. The danger isn't that they'll grow up to be terrorists, it's that they'll grow up to be Arabs. I don't know if she thinks like you go through puberty and become Arab or something, like you don't start out Arab. And I'm going to read, and this for audio only people, I'm going to translate what this woman's saying. So do you know how many civilians have been killed in Gaza? Let's hear what she has to say. Better if we stop here. You don't want to answer? No.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask why? Because I don't think there's anyone innocent there. Sorry. Do you know how many civilians have been killed in Gaza? Another woman. No, and it also doesn't interest me. Why? I don't care. So yeah, that's for the Ask Project. So shout out to Corey Jill Schuster, who has a website, a YouTube channel that's about knowing what Israelis and Palestinians really think. And he just interviews random people on the street.
What was that show called? Like, kids say the darndest things. So yeah. This could be called Israelis say the racist most racist things. Things. The racist yeah. things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Insane. Yeah.
And people might say, oh, you know, you're just cherry picking these rant. But, you know, I honestly know if you look at the polls in Israel, yeah. I'm sorry. This is what a majority of people think.
Yep.
And this is what happens when you create an ethnostate on someone else's land is you're going to develop racist views like this. It's just going to be part of the social fabric.
Yeah, it's inevitable. Yeah. And those have been your four basic food groups.
If you asked our critics, they'd tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant. And since 2011, they've been making high quality, long lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the No BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes, and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Code USEFUL.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Over the past 75 years, more than 10,000 chemicals have entered our food supply, but the EU allows just 300 additives. At Thrive Market, we prioritize quality, banning over 1,000 ingredients found in conventional grocery stores. Our Healthy Swap scanner helps you find better versions of your pantry essentials without the junk, dyes, or fillers, and everything is delivered right to your doorstep. So shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health at thrivemarket.com/getstarted for 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
We are so honored to be speaking with Dr. Tanya Hajj Hassan, who is a pediatric intensive care physician who works with humanitarian and health organizations, including Doctors Without Borders. She's co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from healthcare professionals in Gaza. And she has been to Gaza several times, and she's joining us now from Amman, Jordan. Welcome, Dr. Hajj Hassan. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it, especially given how busy you are and all the important work that you're doing. Can you just start off by telling us what brought you to Gaza in the first place and the kind of work that you've been doing there?
Yes, of course. So when I was a medical student at Oxford University, I struck up a chat with one of the surgeons one day about how medical education must be so difficult in occupied Palestine in general, particularly since people can't move and our job as we're training requires us to move and learn from different, you know, hospitals and also attend various conferences to remain connected with the global medical community. And so we were both very interested in medical education, and we ended up kind of forming a connection called Oxpal MedLink that connected, you know, medical education at Oxford with that in the West Bank and Gaza. And then ultimately I joined this group that went every year that we could to initially to the West Bank and then West Bank and Gaza. And then when we realized that Gaza was, the medical community in Gaza was much more cut off and, was benefiting more, we started just going to the Gaza Strip. So we would go teach medical students and young doctors and then attend kind of evening academic discussions with the more senior medical community. And we did that over the last decade. And there's nothing normal about it, but every time that there was an assault on the Gaza Strip, so 2014, 2021, the medical students that we taught and the medical colleagues with whom we fostered relationships over the years would, we would be texting back and forth, checking on them and checking on their families. And they would tell us the situation at the hospitals and what kind of casualties they were seeing. And, you know, this was a conversation that we almost were used to having with them, unfortunately. And we realized that this time it was different. The kinds of messages that we were getting from them were much more concerning in what they were describing. You know, within the first 5 days after October 7th, we were hearing them say things like we're being exterminated, or, you know, they're killing us at an unprecedented rate. We were, you know, they would mention hundreds of mass casualties coming in at once, or hundreds of victims coming in with each mass casualty. And that's not, you know, that's not normal in any context. And there's nothing normal about war, but if you want to compare across war zones, it's also not typical of war zones to see, you know, entire families coming in as casualties in the kinds of numbers they were coming in. So that's how I got involved in trying to share the messages of our medical colleagues there, and then ultimately trying to join a team and then going in with one of the emergency medical teams to see if I could help in a more hands-on, concrete way, and also as a form of solidarity with my colleagues there.
And you've been extremely eloquent and passionate, understandably, about what you've been seeing. And you've called this a genocide. Can you explain why this is a genocide, in your opinion, and what it was like saying that on CNN?
This humanitarian crisis, with the additional factor of Gaza is about to enter the winter, which often brings heavy rain to the region.
Kate, in all honesty, a humanitarian crisis is what you deal with when you have a hurricane, what you deal with when you have an earthquake. You have an insult and a humanitarian response. This is my career. This is what I do for a living. Every single person who does this for a living will tell you the same thing. This is different. This is not a humanitarian crisis. Kate, and I'm going to say it very clearly for your viewers to hear, this is genocide.
So I'm not a legal scholar, and I can't make that legal determination. And so you may or may not have noticed that it wasn't something that I was calling out early on, and I waited until those with the credibility, knowledge, and background to call it that made that determination.
And I think, you know, it meets all the criteria. And that's what you need. You need it to meet the criteria, and that's it. And we've seen the criteria. The intention's been made very, very clear and explicit by multiple leaders within, you know, the Israeli government and military. We've seen evidence of it on the ground in all its forms. And we've also seen international organizations with the credibility to make that kind of statement, you know, organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And a year ago this month, the International Court of Justice, you know, ruling plausible genocide and putting in place preliminary measures. And so I think for me, it's not a matter of debate anymore. That's a really unfortunate thing. You know, for so long, people considered it some kind of controversial determination or even an opinion. At this point, it's not. It's just stating fact the way you state, in my opinion, the way you would state any other fact when you have so much evidence on the ground.
Going back to your very brave condemnation of genocide on CNN, you said that the media is going to have to reconcile with its complicity in this. Can you expand on what you meant by that?
So the reporting on this has been censored, biased, silenced from the very beginning. International journalists, as you know, are not let in, and there's been not near the amount of outrage there should be from mainstream media about that. I think people just accepted it, shockingly, even though it's unprecedented. There hasn't been outrage, with the exception of a couple news channels, about the number of journalists that have been killed. Record numbers, again, silence. We hear about Ukraine, we hear about domestic issues, with a level of horror that if we were to, you know, proportionate to the horror occurring, report on Palestine, it would just take up all the news. And instead, it takes up snippets. And what we usually hear is the narrative of the Israeli military. And things are constantly, you know, even myself, when I come on for an interview, I'm often waiting for 15 minutes or so off air. So you sign on about 15 minutes early. And so I listen to the reporting that comes before me, and they sandwich the human impact in a 2 or 3 minute interview in between various interviews that attempt to justify it when there is no justification. And we know that the majority of all of those justifications that we heard are just military propaganda and frankly, just false. And so when you hear, for example, for the entire time that Shifa was besieged multiple times and then ultimately destroyed, you know, they'll report on it. And then they'll say, you know, the IDF states that it's a control center for Hamas. And then, it's proven that it wasn't. But there's no reporting on that. People are left with that snippet of news. And then they move to the next hospital, Nasser Hospital. Media reports the same thing. They don't question it. They share it as facts. But if they share the Palestinian perspective, which has consistently been factual for the most part, they cast doubt on it. And they will almost never bring on Palestinian authoritative voices to discuss it. They'll just report it as by casting doubt, essentially, that it's factual nature. And when you do hear about the Palestinian, you know, when you do hear about what's happening on the ground in Gaza, you hear it from foreigners, you hear it from people like me who go and come. You will very rarely hear, for example, Palestinian doctors brought on air. And that happened recently this past month, the last week on CNN. And frankly, I was pleasantly shocked, but I shouldn't be. You know, that should be the first point of reference, is for them to bring on Palestinian healthcare workers to discuss what's happening in their hospitals. But it isn't. I mean, how many times did you see Dr. Sam Abu Safi being interviewed by any of those news networks in the 3 months when he was pleading for international protection, when they were showing daily evidence of attacks on the hospital? A lot of mainstream journalists who we've gotten to know very well over the last 15 months will tell you that they are being silenced within their news networks. They will tell you that they produce reports that are heavily edited to the point where they're unrecognizable. One of my colleagues recently wrote a piece for a very large journal and spent months working on it and ultimately decided not to list their name on the piece because it had been so heavily edited that they didn't feel like it represented their, you know, the integrity of their profession anymore. And I think that's, you know, we see that over and over again. I remember an incident with the BBC, for example, where a report was published and then hours later was removed from kind of the headline area, removed way down and heavily edited. And it was one of the few reports that were critical of Israel. And it turns out we heard internally that it was as a consequence of the Israeli authorities getting in touch and essentially threatening. And I think, and that's what I mean by complicity. Journalism is journalism. You present objective facts, and you present objective facts by searching for the stories and by creating time for the stories. And we don't see that. We don't see a humanization of Palestinians. We don't see Palestinian lives valued or reported in the same way they report Israeli lives, for example. Palestinians passively die. Israelis are actively killed. Palestinians come in numbers or in estimated numbers. Israelis come with names and stories and entire programs that highlight their humanity. And if, you know, the difference in the way things are reported is striking. There's a Palestinian exceptionalism. I think that's pervasive within journalism as well.
Can you tell us about some of your medical colleagues in Gaza? I know you've lost people to Israeli attacks. I know it's hard to summarize, but just share for us, if you can, some details about the people, the brave doctors you've worked with on the ground in Gaza.
I know both of you know this. I'm not sure what kind of exposure your viewers or listeners have to what's going on the ground, but there have been over 1,000 healthcare workers in Gaza that we know of that have been killed to date by the Israeli military. We know that there have been well over 300. I don't know the exact number. We're about 3 months out of date with our numbers here, but as of 3 months ago, before the incursion into the north, there were over 300 healthcare professionals that were detained. Those who were released were reporting horrific accounts of torture and detained without charge. And four of our medical colleagues died in Israeli detention, presumably from torture. And that's, you know, that's, I'm only speaking about medical professionals. There are thousands of other Palestinians in prisons, unlawfully detained, and who were hearing witness accounts of extreme levels of physical and psychological torture, as well as, I'm sure you've heard, a lot of sexual torture as well, and rape. Those are kind of crude numbers of healthcare workers that have been killed. Just to give you a bigger picture, and then what that means for the healthcare sector, I think about 24-25% of all senior physicians in Gaza have either been killed, unlawfully detained, or fled at this point. So that means that a quarter of the medical expertise, unfortunately, has for the most part been either exterminated or detained or pushed out. Personally, what that means, I guess, for me and for every colleague I know in Gaza is every single healthcare colleague that I know in Gaza knows multiple other healthcare workers that they've worked with, that they work with, who have been killed, and many who have been detained as well. You know, I just scroll through, my Instagram account, and I see condolence after condolence. If I just pick one colleague, for example, one of my colleagues who evacuated last year and is living outside of Gaza at the moment, before the Egyptian border had closed, and I go through my Instagram account of how many times I've offered him condolences for family, for for colleagues, for friends of his that have been killed. It feels like every week, every 2 weeks, you run out of words to provide condolences. And the same thing is true for my colleagues that are inside Gaza. I feel like, you know, if I think of one particular colleague who is doing significantly better off than most of my other colleagues there, because this colleague is working for an international organization and so still gets a salary. This particular colleague has lost multiple members of her family. She has lost multiple members of her healthcare worker community, many of whom she's told me stories about in the past. You know, and you just sit there and, yeah. I have another colleague who is currently in Cairo, was in Cairo prior to October 7th last year, doing sort of advanced medical training. And he tells me he's lost so many of his teachers and his mentors. Me personally, several of the students that I've taught in the past in Gaza have been killed by the Israeli military in the last 15 months. The head of the medical school, or one of the medical schools where I used to teach, there are two medical schools in Gaza, was killed, along with his daughter, who was also a young doctor and a previous student of mine. It's you reach a point where it's so sad, but you just finish mourning the loss of somebody you know, and then you receive the next bit of news. And I think that's characteristic of everything we've been witnessing since October of last year. You know, just as an example, on Christmas Day, five journalists in a press-marked vehicle were killed by a direct airstrike. A day later, Kamal Adwan Hospital is raided and burned down. Dr. Hassan Abu Safiya, the director, is, we're told, beaten and taken away to Israeli prisons. Again, no charge. They've gone in multiple times to the hospital. They've never taken him before. They've never tried to arrest him. They always communicate with him. He's been communicating with the world. And I think that's his only, it can't be a charge, but I think that's the only thing that I suspect they have against him is the fact that he has been a witness. And that's just characteristic. And just now, you know, we're trying to keep up to share some of the news that we're hearing on the inside, and we just can't keep up. I mean, just today, one of my colleagues was sending me photos and details about a woman who had given birth the day prior. Her newborn was unwell, and she was in an ambulance to Kamal Adwan Hospital. When the ambulance was hit by a direct Israeli airstrike, there's video footage of this. Nobody was able to get to the casualty, so the ambulance driver, the woman, her friend who was with her in the ambulance, and her baby, the woman and her friend were killed. And the baby, and I believe the ambulance driver, were left. The baby was miraculously found 24 hours later alive and taken to hospital, injured and orphaned. And the woman and her friend's corpses or bodies were eaten by stray dogs, were mauled by stray dogs afterwards. But this is, you know, it's one bit of news, and it's so horrific. And if it happened anywhere else in the world, or it had happened in isolation, you'd have time to report on it and to share it with the world. But you move on the next day. And my partner was telling me just yesterday that he could not believe that incident with the five journalists on Christmas Day was just skirted past. It was as if it never happened. Never any accountability, never any international reporting, never any outrage from global mainstream media over five of their colleagues being killed in a very clear targeted attack on a press-marked vehicle. And on the background of record numbers of journalists killed since October of last year. It's so hard to have enough time to mourn one thing without being met with the next heinous atrocity.
Well, speaking of Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, there's this very iconic photo that has been making the rounds, understandably, of him. He's the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, and we see him walking unarmed towards these IDF tanks, and then he's abducted. Let's take a look, though, at a video of him after he himself a couple months ago was back in November was injured. And he has an important message to say. It's also worth noting that his son was also killed. So that is that doctor, extremely brave doctor who refused to leave the hospital, refused to leave his patients, was himself injured, lost his son, and was then kidnapped and is now in State Teman, which is, as people may know, a site of torture, including sexual torture. And it's also where Dr. Adnan al-Bursh was killed. And it's reported by witnesses that he was essentially raped to death, sexually tortured to death. What are people in the medical community saying about what is happening to this doctor?
I think for healthcare workers who take their oath seriously and refuse to be racist, who refuse to dehumanize, who apply the same values of their praxis to everyone, they're outraged. And you may have seen videos going around of healthcare workers globally holding up signs calling for Dr. Hassan al-Bousafia's release. You know, I remember when this happened at Nasser Hospital, and we were pushing really hard for the release of Dr. Khalid Assur, which took months, and during which time he was also subjected to torture in Israeli detention. He was ultimately released because he had no crime other than, like I said, bearing witness and communicating with the outside world. So I think at the time there was outrage. There were healthcare workers making statements globally. I guess there are two points to make. One is that healthcare workers are outraged. Healthcare workers who are true to their oaths are outraged. And then you have the rest who are silenced, and who don't want to risk their positions for a community that they feel like they don't want to fight for or don't want to risk anything for. And the reality, true solidarity means risking something. And I can tell you, as someone who's working in the North American healthcare system, that we are silenced, and that when we speak out, we pay the price. And if you're not willing to pay that price, and I'm telling you this from personal experience, I had a very difficult time at my hospital before I left this summer. And I think there's a price to pay. And if you don't have the courage, or you're not willing to pay that price, then you're going to remain silent. But the reality is, being silent in the face of the intentional decimation of an entire healthcare system, the intentional killing and targeting of healthcare workers, the intentional detention and torture of healthcare workers for no other crime other than providing healthcare, is complicity. And it's, an indirect way of saying, not all lives are important to us, and our oath applies not to everyone, but to those whom it's convenient to apply it to. When you work in the American healthcare system, you aren't given the freedom to show solidarity with Palestinian healthcare workers. You're not allowed the freedom to express any form of solidarity with the Palestinian people, with patients, with healthcare workers, to express outrage about the intentional targeting of the healthcare system and healthcare workers. And you are either directly or indirectly attacked if you show solidarity in this form. And I can tell you that was my experience. I can tell you that was the experience of most healthcare workers that I know. Fortunately, many people in healthcare, like many people in your field of journalism and many people in, you know, the legal fields and all these fields that are that have been outspoken about this and who've taken oaths and hold a lot of integrity in their profession, refuse silence and have the courage to continue to speak about these things, even if it comes at a professional cost to themselves.
I mean, I think that it's really important to highlight what's happening to Palestinian healthcare workers and patients, which you've been doing. But I also want to say that it is important for people to know the price that is paid, that people face consequences, that people who are medical providers, who are North American medical providers, also face pressure to not speak out. I just think it's an important point so that people realize that even when we do hear people like you speaking out, think about how many people aren't speaking out. And so, in other words, it's even worse than we know about. It's more pervasive. The things that you're describing are more pervasive than we know about. And it also speaks to behemoth that it is trying to silence people and vilify the people of Palestine and anyone who is in solidarity with them.
There is most definitely a Palestinian exceptionalism. There is an exceptionalism when it comes to humanizing Palestinian people. There's exceptionalism when it comes to standing in solidarity vocally with the Palestinian people, even when it comes to providing medical care to Palestinian children who are evacuated and in need of medical care in the pediatric international medical community. There is a Palestinian exceptionalism to our compassion as medical professionals. And frankly, it's disgusting.
The only context in which, you know, the word exceptionalism should be applied to Palestine is how exceptional the healthcare system was in Gaza under impossible conditions. I wonder if you could talk about that, what Israel has destroyed, how Palestinians were able to, living under siege, living under blockade before October 7th, build up a really impressive healthcare system that took care of people.
I'm really glad you bring that up, Aaron, because I think it's something people don't recognize. People who don't know Gaza don't know what an incredible place it is for its people and their determination to really care for each other, to create community, to build each other up. And that's, I think, most clearly seen in education. Education is extremely important for Palestinians. And I don't know if you know this, but the Palestinian medical students were taking their exams last week in Gaza, including their specialty exams. And actually, I need to look up the exact details, but a group of them were struck. So they were taking their exams, and the hospital where they were taking their exams was actually hit by an Israeli strike during their exam. And so they postponed it to the following day. So they paused the exam and they said, okay, come back tomorrow, we'll do it again. And that, you know, speaks to two things. One, it speaks to their utter and complete determination to continue to improve themselves and to produce healthcare workers who are very good at what they do, despite the conditions in which, you know, that they're facing. And two, it tells you, sadly, that they're used to this. They're used to constantly being attacked. Gaza, some people talk about Gaza being under siege for the last 15 months. Gaza's been under siege for over 17 years now. And most of these students who have been born in the Gaza Strip, educated in elementary, middle, high school, and then ultimately medical school, entirely in the Gaza Strip. And many of them will stay on and do their specialty training there too. And I can tell you, they are incredibly capable physicians, surgeons, nurses, despite growing up in an environment where they're completely besieged. I'll give you an example. I went to medical school, so I did my undergraduate in the US. I then went on to the UK. I did graduate entry medicine at Oxford. I stayed on. I did a couple of masters there, and I stayed on there, health-related masters. I stayed on in the UK, and then I went to the US, and I did residency. I worked for several years all over the world with Doctors Without Borders, and then I went back and I did critical care fellowship in Canada. I ran around the world searching for best opportunities to give me the best training I possibly could get so that I am most competent at caring for my patients. when I work with physicians in Gaza, I'm working with, to me, what feels like equally trained and exceptional physicians. These are doctors who were born and bred in the Gazan healthcare system. It was an elaborate healthcare system. They had hospitals throughout the Gaza Strip. At Shifa Hospital was kind of, someone I consider my mentor in critical care in Gaza. They call him the father of critical care in Gaza. He's a Gazan intensive care doctor. He called Al Shifa Hospital the beating heart of Gaza's healthcare system, the largest hospital, and was recently renovated before October of last year. So, and there were two medical schools. Both medical schools have been attacked in previous Israeli aggressions on the Gaza Strip. One of them had been completely destroyed, decimated. After one of my last visits there, or one of my previous visits there, when I went back the next time, they had built the entire thing back up again. And it was running, and they were super proud. They were especially proud that the female medical students were doing so much better than the male medical students. It was like a source of pride for the university. They're incredible. I went to the first evidence-based medicine conference in Gaza. So they created their own evidence-based medicine conference. And they were very proud about that. They publish a lot of papers. They do what the rest of us in the medical community do by interacting and traveling and going to various conferences. But they do it despite all the odds and without the ability to leave the Gaza Strip for most Gazan healthcare workers. Some are fortunate and receive permits to leave and do additional training abroad. But you know, the majority of Gazan healthcare workers are trained internally.
And also Gaza, Palestine has one of the highest literacy rates in the world, and Gaza even higher than the West Bank. And that is in large part because of UNRWA, which, of course, Israel has targeted, tried to present as a terrorist organization. And the U.S. has stopped funding, even though other countries, other governments that announced they'd stop funding when Israel lied and said it was a terrorist organization, at least those other countries have reinstated the funding. The U.S. has not. So just another example of like the challenges being faced by.
I don't even know what to say to that anymore. The fact that UNRWA was defunded and attacked to start with is just so outrageous. And I hope your viewers are intelligent and recognize the absurdity of defunding an organization that was the lifeline for all Palestinians, and that every NGO or every humanitarian organization that works in Gaza Strip will tell you that.
Right.
These accusations are empty, and it's unfortunate what it's led to. And you know, UNRWA is not just a lifeline for Palestinians in Gaza; it's a lifeline for Palestinians in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Jordan, throughout the region. And it also, and I think this is an important political point, we don't often talk about politics, but it's important to understand why UNRWA is threatening to this entire project. UNRWA signifies, you know, a right of Palestinians to return to their homeland.
It also teaches them about their history. Like in UNRWA schools, Palestinian kids, contrary to what Israel claims about their race to, you know, support terror and all that, just a pure falsification. They're taught their own history. They're taught to be proud to be Palestinian. And in the eyes of Israel, that's intolerable. I mean, I think that was a major factor in why it had to be wiped out, is because it preserves Palestinian nationhood and keeps, as you said, instills in people the right that they have to return to their homes from which they were expelled. And again, it's just, you know, speaking of, like, we look at all the propaganda campaigns that the corporate media here has taken part in, the painting all hospitals as Hamas terror centers, and same thing with UNRWA and its schools too, as being, you know, just trying to raise people to promote hatred and terrorism and all that stuff. It's, yeah.
I've worked in and around UNRWA facilities for years in the Middle East in general. And it's a lifeline, and it provides all the things that you need to provide to a community that's been displaced from social services, from their own social services. And it's something Palestinians are very proud of. The majority of the employees are Palestinian. They do excellent work. They have really great programs for children who are going through childhoods that are, you know, trauma upon trauma upon trauma. It creates a community have support and social services that is a lifeline for this population.
Can you talk about what happened, what has happened to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital where you worked? People probably know that there were in November, someone was people were basically burned alive while attached to an IV. There was a disgusting example of this, Shahan al-Dalu, which made some headlines or at least social media. Are you in communication with people who are at that hospital? And can you share other stories that you have from working at that hospital?
Yeah, absolutely. So the emergency department of the hospital, there's a press tent that's been hit numerous times right outside the emergency department. And there's also a number of tents where internally displaced persons have sought shelter. So people that were forcibly transferred from other areas within the Gaza Strip. Some of them were actually my colleagues. I had a nursing colleague who was living outside the hospital door with her family. I had other colleagues. There was a young child who worked with us regularly in the emergency department who was also living in the area and being cared for by members of the press who because that child was alone without parents there. And so he was being cared for by the team, the journalists in the press tent. So that area where people had set up tents has been hit multiple times, and that was an example of when it was hit and caught fire, and there was the young man who was burned alive that we caught a video of. I mean, the reality is so many people have been burned alive in Gaza, and unfortunately we cannot share their stories because, as you know, international journalists are not let in, and Palestinian journalists, like as I was saying earlier, it's just so hard to keep up with the atrocities that are happening there. But yeah, a lot of my colleagues who I worked with are still in Al-Aqsa Hospital working in the emergency department and the intensive care unit and the pediatric unit. Every time there's a large mass casualty, you know, they send us stories. And sometimes I stop before sharing them because they're often so dehumanizing, and I struggle between, you know, wanting to show the world how egregious these crimes are and how horrific the suffering of the Palestinian people are and the types of injuries that are coming into the hospital, but also recognizing that these Palestinian patients, their caretakers, the healthcare workers that care for them are very dignified people who should be remembered by so much more than their last moments, you know, when they're in the example of the young man you mentioned who loved to play the guitar and who was very interested in pursuing his education. You know, you want to remember him by those things, not by the last image of him being burned alive. But at the same time, people need to know those things are happening. But every single day, the team in Al-Aqsa Hospital, as is true for the teams in all hospitals that are still, you know, partially functioning in Gaza, they are receiving casualties and tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the conflict that you feel. I also think it's important personally to not kind of conflate like there's nothing weak about being at the receiving end of a genocidal rampage, right? It's just what happens. But I totally understand that you want people to be remembered in their full humanity, while at the same time, the world needs to know about what's happening to people and also what Israel is doing. Like, they need to know that this is not just, you know, like, you know, war is terrible. Things happen in war. Like, it's important for people to know about how the injuries reveal targeting. I mean, there was that op-ed by a doctor talking about how there were babies and children had bullet wounds to the head and chest, yeah, showing that they were sniped and targeted. This was not just some explosion. Not that, I mean, Israel has no right to be touching a single body, a single like hair of a body of a Palestinian, but it's not even just a, these aren't just casualties of war. Can you talk about any injuries that you've seen that indicate this kind of targeting?
I cared for one child that had a in and out penetrating injury to the head, gunshot wound, and he died. For the most part, when I was in Gaza, I was in Deir el-Bala, and at the time that I was there, the ground invasion wasn't to the extent that it is now. It was mostly aerial bombardment. And so a lot of what we were seeing were entire families that were being wiped out. And I remember one instance where multiple children were brought in at the same time, laid on the floor, and three were dead. And we declared them dead right then and there. I mentioned this happens all the time. The reason it was a little bit unusual that day is because usually when so many are killed at once, they're not, they're very clearly dead, as you've probably seen on Instagram, where people are dismembered and it, you know, it's very clear that somebody's not alive. In this case, these three infants almost looked like they were sleeping, but they were dead. So blast injury, internal types of injuries that aren't so evident on the outside. So they just looked like they were sleeping. But all of this to say, entire families were coming in, and I can't tell you at the time that they were intentionally targeting children, because this was aerial bombardment. So we were receiving entire families, with the exception of those that were clearly that had gunshot wounds. The rest were just entire families that were hit by aerial bombardment. But I can tell you that the testimonies we're receiving from their families suggest that they were just, you know, civilians in a building with extended families, all of whom are civilians, and that there is no clear military reason that they could understand or tie themselves to that would explain why that civilian building was hit. And they would cry and say that in the emergency department. They'd be like, why? We have nothing to do. I swear to God, I've never had anything to do with, you know, and they would sit there sobbing and telling you that they had nothing to do, that there was no reason for them to be targeted. I remember one woman who'd lost her child, and her older, I think 6-year-old child was in the ICU with us with severe brain injury. And I remember her telling us that, you know, her husband was worked in a, I believe it was a dairy factory. And she said, my husband works in a dairy factory. We were in the middle of our prayer, you know, our family prayer, it was Ramadan, when they hit us. I just don't understand why they would do this to us. And I didn't have the heart to tell her that her daughter would probably never speak again or interact again, given the degree of traumatic brain injury that she had. And the fact she'd also lost her younger child in that same attack. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, a lot of the targeted attacks that that were witnessed by that team afterwards, that the team that published that op-ed, were when the ground invasion had progressed.
You have been to Gaza several times. You keep going back. I mean, do you fear for your own safety? Do you fear that you could be killed? And if so, how do you find the strength to keep going back?
I think it's normal to have some fear for your own safety. And I think anybody that goes to Gaza has that recognition. You know, you're going into a war zone where essentially there is indiscriminate killing of everybody. But at the same time, our colleagues have been enduring this for 15 months straight, and it's intolerable and unbearable to watch it from the outside. I think we go back to help, to relieve them. I already told you that they're highly experienced, but they've been doing this for 15 months straight and they're exhausted. And so we go to relieve them. We go to show solidarity, and we go to bear witness. But I think it's not that we don't recognize the risks associated with going. It's that not doing anything is intolerable and feels very deeply wrong, particularly when you swore an oath to do this kind of work where people need it. And this is probably a context where people need it most, more than any other context that I've experienced in my lifetime. a situation where so few people are let in and so few people are able to bear witness or able to stand hand in hand. To turn that opportunity down is too grave of a betrayal.
Thank you for what you do. It's really inspiring. And it's unfortunate that you have to be risking your life to do your job, and that you're risking your life because of a genocide that's being facilitated by the United States government. I feel like every day there's like a double, there's double pain. There's the pain of seeing what's happening to the people of Palestine. And then there's the pain and kind of hopelessness that I feel as someone who knows that my tax dollars are going to this.
I feel you, Katie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I think about this all the time, and I think about, and it actually impacts my decisions, my work decisions about where I want to be spending my money. And it impacts, and I think we've known this for a long time. I remember protesting the Iraq war and protesting the Syrian war. And, I've known this for a long time. I think I just didn't recognize how facilitated this kind of mass killing of civilians on this side of the world is by the United States.
You mentioned that you want to recognize the full humanity of Palestinians and show the world that they're, not just victims and not just dismembered bodies. So I was hoping you could share with us some of the stories of individuals who have been killed. So you can do that. So patients, colleagues, sharing the humanity of some of these people.
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the people that often comes to mind for me is Dr. Mohammed Ghanem, because he's a young ER doctor who was one of our students previously and was in the north. And so he'd moved from one hospital to another. He was at Al-Shifa Hospital, Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital, Kamal Adwan Hospital. He basically moved every time the Israeli forces invaded a hospital and he had to forcibly move to another, forcibly leave. He would just move to the next hospital and work there. And I think he's in the Indonesian hospital as well. So he basically moved in between the hospitals and he kept a diary. And I had asked him if he would let me translate his diary and share it. And he consented to that. And so I spent some time translating his diary and really, mulling over each word. And he was someone who was gentle. And I can actually read, if you give me a second to pull it up, I can read some of his friends' testimonies about him too. But he was a very gentle person who was inspiringly committed to his work, to his colleagues, to his patients. So Dr. Mohammed Ghanem was killed alongside his father. And he started keeping a diary in January of this past year. So January 15th, 2024 was his first entry. And he described moving from one hospital to another. But he starts out his diary by saying, "I write these lines to document my journey if I'm gone and to remind myself if I manage to stay alive." And then he goes on and describes his journey. He shares multiple photos, including a photo of him and a cat that he got to know during the siege, including, photos of bullets in the hospital windows and walls, including one of the first times he got to eat bread after being besieged for a long time. So it's a very moving account. He goes on to describe his fear for his family as the tanks and shells were getting closer and closer to his family that was in Jabalia camp. The only major hospital that was in the north of Gaza and operating at the time was Kamal Adwan Hospital. This was January of last year. He said that injuries were coming to them from all parts of the city, Gaza City and the north, including Jabalia camp where his family was. And so he kept preparing himself to see his family amongst the injured and the dead. And what made things worse was that communications were cut off at the time. So when casualties would come in, he would ask them where they were from in that area and whether his family were amongst the casualties. And he describes the physical impact of working 24 hours. He said he was the only ER doctor on any workday because there were only two emergency medicine doctors in the hospital. And as the days passed, he said, I felt like I had been in this state for years. Anyway, I can share his diary with you if that would be helpful. But it was really hard to translate it with the intent of sharing his journey with the world to protect him and everybody like him who's struggling to stay alive, to keep their families alive. And then to hear that after all of that, he was killed. And, you know, someone who represented everything good about the world. I think I shared this in one previous interview, but I'm going to share it with you again, this particular paragraph, because I think it's important. He said, as much as I could, this is one of his later entries, I tried to share my experience between the hospitals for documentation, and I stayed away from the tragic stories for two reasons. The first reason is that I know it's of no use. For those who couldn't be moved by pictures of dismembered and charred corpses will not be moved by some words. And the second is that I can't find words to describe the stories. And then he goes on to describe some of the stories. He said, for how could I describe the scene of a three-year-old child like an angel with yellow hair and blue eyes lying on the bed and the occupation burned half of her face and upper part of her body, killed her mother and paralyzed her father, except that she is indifferent to her body and asks me every day, have I seen her father and mother? The whole while I was there, I tried to relieve her and hurry to check on her, but then move on to another patient before she had a chance to ask about her family again. Standing next to her, I was paralyzed to utter a single letter, but my attempts failed and I was faced with the most difficult question that day. And then he goes on to describe the hysteria of a boy after he lost consciousness for less than a day. And when he woke up, the first question he asked was, is the war over? He describes one of his colleagues being brought in. He describes losing communication with two of his colleagues, Dr. Abdullah Mundar al-Badri and his brother, Dr. Hashim, and how they kept searching for him in the emergency room between the casualties and in the morgue. And then he said, how does he describe how the emergency department turned into a funeral where we constantly say, may Allah reward you, instead of hello between colleagues. Essentially, he's referring to the fact that they were always providing condolences to each other because they were constantly losing colleagues. Anyway, the last photo, at least in this diary that I translated that he shared, was a photo of the emergency medical team where he was working at Al-Shifa. And he said, we were 13 doctors in the emergency department. All of us were tortured to different degrees. And six doctors were injured or arrested. This is during the third time Al-Shifa Hospital was besieged. He said this was the most severe, both in terms of the siege, incursion, and the amount of destruction. When he said that they were only 13 doctors in the emergency department, six of them were injured or arrested. He said, I'm only talking about the department I was in charge of, and I'm not talking about the doctors who were executed directly from other departments after they were arrested or the doctors whose fate is still unknown. And he shared the picture of the emergency medical team doctor's list and next to several names. So, for example, Dr. Wasim Mohani, he writes, injured. Dr. Mustafa Hayyam, he writes, arrested. Dr. Khalil Skake, I think, he says injured and then arrested. Dr. Yahya Al-Masri, arrested, Dr. Hamid Abu Khair arrested. And, you know, he goes through the just the list of emergency medicine doctors that he was working with, and one by one lists their fate. And I think that it's terrifying to think that the colleagues we knew and the colleagues we know today are like this very list, if you were to list them one by one, to know that they're either injured, arrested, killed, or will be injured, arrested, or killed unless we do something now. And everybody we know is emaciated. There was a study last month that came out that showed the average weight loss in the first, say, like 6 or 7 months after October 7th in Gaza was over 18 kilos, average weight loss per person. I don't know what that number would be like now. I suspect probably about double that. So you're talking about, you know, a sizable percentage of people's body mass. And you see that, you no longer recognize them. They're emaciated.
Just like 40 pounds for...
Yeah.
That, yeah. Ms. Rachel, who is a kind of like a Mr. Rogers type figure, she has a YouTube show that uses singing to educate children. She posted on her Instagram, 3 babies died of hypothermia in Gaza the past few days. Over 14,500 have been killed total. Children have the right to live. And in response to that, Stop Anti-Semitism tweeted, Ms. Rachel continues to spew her propaganda about Gaza numbers, never once mentioning the babies kidnapped or murdered by Hamas. Also, it's in the 50s, 60s in Gaza, not exactly freezing weather. Can you address this claim that given that because it's in the 50s and 60s, there isn't hypothermia?
Yeah, sure. I mean, before I do that, that number that we know of is that 7 infants who died of hypothermia, and 8 people in total have died of hypothermia so far in the last week. It is cold. I'm in Jordan, about 200 kilometers away from Gaza right now, and it is cold. It is very cold. You can't see it, but I'm wearing a heat tech Uniqlo top underneath my blouse, and I have an electric heater turned on right next to me in addition to the household heating. And I just moved here from Canada, so this isn't me being a wuss. It is actually cold. It has also been raining continuously for about a week. A family member of mine gave birth on Christmas Eve, and they've been too worried to take the baby out, even bundled. So it is very wet. I took the dog out a couple days ago in the rain because she needed to be walked, and she got soaked. We both got soaked, and I was shivering by the time I got to the house. I am a grown-ass adult with subcutaneous fat and glycogen stores. A baby is not. A baby does not have sufficient subcutaneous fat. A baby does not have sufficient stores of glycogen, so the storage form of sugar or glucose. And so when a baby gets cold, a baby stays cold and just gets colder and cannot produce glucose needed to make energy, then they become hypoglycemic as well, and eventually they die. And so babies are very predisposed to hypothermia or to this dangerous level of being cold for people who don't know what hypothermia is. And the smaller you are in size, so as children get younger, and particularly true for babies, the higher your surface area to volume ratio, which makes it more likely that you also lose heat and become very cold. So you're more likely to lose heat and become cold, and you don't have ways of generating energy when you need to when you're cold. And they're wet and they can't get dry because they're intense. And Israel is obstructing all the aid, according to the WHO and the UN, all the aid that would be needed to reinforce these tents. So tents and blankets and clothes for warmth are obstructing it from entering, but it's there sitting at the border ready to come in, and they're obstructing it from entering. So people are getting very, very cold. And when you get that cold and you're wet and you're young and you're malnourished, because malnutrition is also a risk factor for hypothermia, and you're much more likely to become hypothermic if you're malnourished. Whoever said that, it's just frankly just false. And anytime I hear people say, oh, but you don't mention these things, or you're lying about the numbers, or it just immediately tells me that this is someone who does not humanize Palestinians. That's all you need to know. It's irrelevant whether it's 40,000 or 5,000 or 50,000 or 200,000. Obviously, higher numbers is worse, but it's just to say that it's irrelevant. These are human lives. And when we sit there and debate the numbers, you lose the bigger picture. And on the topic of numbers, I'm not here to debate, but the reality is the estimated numbers that are coming out from the UN are grossly underestimated. We know that. We know that from the past. You know, Palestinian authorities have in the past, if anything, underestimated casualties. This is, you know, on previous assaults on Gaza. Sorry, when I say Palestinian authorities, I mean not the political group, but Palestinians who are in positions that share these sorts of statistics. And we know from the past that they vastly underestimate these figures. And in this particular case, we know that tens of thousands of people are missing. You know, months ago, we knew that Save the Children was saying over 20,000 children are missing. Over 20,000 children that are unaccounted for in these statistics that are provided because they're maybe buried in mass graves, maybe detained, because we know that children are also being detained, separated from their families, maimed beyond recognition so that you cannot identify their body as deceased. The numbers that are being listed are people whose bodies have been retrieved and who are identifiable, and who the broken healthcare system and system of census taking was able to capture. So you know it's vastly underestimated. And these are these traumatic deaths. What about all the other deaths? You know, the people that are dying because they don't have lax access to their diabetes medication, or they're dying because they're immunocompromised. And so when they get things that you and I would likely recover from, like a GI bug, you know, a gastrointestinal disease or pneumonia, they die because they're so immunocompromised, because they can't access medical care, because they can't access the medications that they need to treat these self-limiting diseases. These are all direct consequences of the way that Israel has architectured its aggression on the civilian population of Gaza. And they're not going to be counted in these statistics. So while I'm telling you numbers shouldn't matter when you're talking about human lives, numbers are also vastly underestimated. But yeah, that comment about hypothermia is just medically incorrect.
Yeah. And it has to do also with rain, not just temperatures. And of course, the temperatures get lower at night. I was conflicted about even bringing it up, but I just felt like it was such a disgusting piece and desperate piece of propaganda. And to go after this woman who really is like today's Mr. Rogers just shows you how to how much like the claims of anti-Semitism are weaponized in order to whitewash Israel's crimes.
Katie, it is very cold. And I'm telling you this. I mean, every day when I go outside, I shudder to think what families in Gaza are experiencing. And I was telling my family the other day, because they were complaining about olive season and how, you know, it's been a really dry winter relative to what the water needs are in this region. This was about 2 weeks ago, before this flood of rains in the last 2 weeks. And I remember saying, you know, there's part of me that wants rain because I know the earth needs it. And there's part of me that really prays to God that this is an incredibly dry winter, because I don't know how people 200 kilometers away are going to survive a wet winter.
Dr. Tanya Hajj-Hassan, thank you so much for everything you do, for saving the lives of Palestinians, literally, and giving voice to them, including to your medical colleagues. We cannot express our gratitude to you enough. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Very grateful to Dr. Tanya Hajj-Hassan for joining us. My gratitude to her and every other doctor in Gaza is just immeasurable. I can't imagine what it must be like to be there on the ground doing the kind of work she does, seeing the things that she's seen. And without people like her giving witness to this genocide, we'd be so much less informed. I mean, the work she does is so vital, not only in saving people's lives, but then in telling us what the reality is, the reality that's been covered up and whitewashed by our media. So just words can't describe how valuable people like her are to our understanding of this genocide. And I just can't imagine what it takes. And I'm extremely grateful to her for joining us.
Yeah, she really is amazing. I remember seeing her months ago, maybe even almost a year ago, when she said that in Gaza, they had a special term, wounded child, no surviving family. So WCNSF. I really admire these doctors, both the doctors of Palestine, as well as the doctors abroad who are working with them.
So much has happened in the world. You know, the whole crisis in Syria that really exploded recently. So people's attention has been diverted away from Gaza, but we just cannot forget this genocide is happening every day. As we talked about, people are literally freezing to death, including babies. And we cannot let this genocide be normalized. That's what is happening, but those of us of conscience can't let that happen. And so someone like Tanya is at the forefront of preventing us from accepting what is being done to the Palestinian people, literally putting herself on the line and using her medical background to try to save who she can. So very grateful to her and every other doctor, medical worker inside Gaza who is doing the impossible.
Thanks so much for watching. We'll see you next week. And of course, please do join us at usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.